if I do say so myself. Instantly a swirling funnel of sand appeared in front of me, and I jumped through. A heartbeat later, I tumbled out at Cleopatra's Needle on the bank of the River Thames. 6 years before, my mother had died here. It wasn't my favourite Egyptian monument, but the Needle was the closest magic portal to Gran and Gramps' flat. Fortunately, the weather was miserable and there was no one about, so I brushed the sand off my clothes and headed for the underground station. 30 minutes later, I stood on the steps of my grandparents' flat. It seemed so odd to be home. I wasn't even sure I could call it that anymore. For months I'd been longing for London, the familiar city streets, my favourite shops, my mates, my old room. I'd even been homesick for the dreary weather. But now everything seemed so different, so foreign. Nervously, I knocked on the door. No answer. I was sure they were expecting me. I knocked again. Perhaps they were hiding, waiting for me to come in. I imagined my grandparents, Liz and Emma, crouching behind the furniture, ready to jump out and yell, "Surprise!" Gran and Gramps, crouching and jumping. Not bloody likely. I fished out my key and unlocked the door. The living room was dark and empty. The stairwell light was off, which Gran would never allow. She was mortally afraid of falling downstairs. Even Gramps' television was switched off, which wasn't right. Gramps always kept the rugby matches on, even if he wasn't watching. He sniffed the air. 6 in the evening, London time, yet no smell of burning biscuits from the kitchen. Gran should have burned at least one tray of biscuits for tea time. It was a tradition. I got out my phone to call Liz and Emma, but the phone was dead. I knew I'd charged the battery. My mind was just beginning to process a thought. I am in danger, when the front door slammed shut behind me. I spun, grabbing for my wand, which I didn't have. Above me, at the... It was a tradition. I got out my phone to call Liz and Emma, but the phone was dead. I knew I'd charged the battery. My mind was just beginning to process a thought. I am in danger, when the front door slammed shut behind me. I spun, grabbing for my wand, which I didn't have. Above me, at the top of the dark stairwell, a voice that was definitely not human hissed,
"Welcome home, Sadie Kane."
5. I learned to really hate dung beetles. Thanks a lot, Sadie. Hand me the mic right when you get to a good part. So, yeah, Sadie left on her birthday trip to London. The world was ending in 4 days, we had a quest to complete, and she goes off to party with her friends. Really had her priorities straight, huh? Not that I was bitter or anything. On the bright side, Brooklyn House was pretty quiet once she left. At least until the three-headed snake showed up. But first I should tell you about my vision. Sadie thought I was hiding something from her at breakfast, right? Well, that was sort of true. Honestly, though, what I saw during the night terrified me so badly I didn't want to talk about it, especially on her birthday. I'd experienced some bizarre stuff since I started learning magic, but this took the Nobel Prize for weird. After our trip to the Brooklyn Museum, I had a tough time getting to sleep. When I finally managed, I awoke in a different body. It wasn't soul travel or a dream. I was Horus the Avenger. I'd shared a body with Horus before. He'd been in my head for almost a week at Christmas, whispering suggestions and otherwise being annoying. During the fight at the Red Pyramid, I'd even experienced a perfect melding of his thoughts and mine. I'd become what Egyptians called the Eye of the God. All of his power at my command, our memories mixing together, human and God working as one. But I'd still been in my own body. This time, things were reversed. I was a guest in Horus's body, standing at the prow of a boat on the magical river that wound through the Duat. My eyesight was as sharp as a falcon's. Through the fog, I could see shapes moving in the water, scaly reptilian backs and monstrous fins. I saw ghosts of the dead drifting along either shore. Far above, the cavern ceiling glistened red, as if we were sailing down the throat of a living beast. My arms were bronze and muscular, circled with bands of gold and lapis lazuli. I was dressed for battle in leather armor, a javelin in one hand and a hepesh in the other. I felt strong and powerful, like, well, a god.
"Hello, Carter,"
said Horace, which felt like talking to myself.
"Horace, what's up?"
I didn't tell him I was irritated by his intrusion into my sleep. I didn't need to. I was sharing his mind.
"I answered your questions," Horace said. "I told you where to find the first scroll. Now you must do something for me. There is something I wish to show you."
The boat lurched forward. I grabbed the railing of the navigator's platform. Looking back, I could see the boat was a pharaoh's bark, about 60 feet long and shaped like a massive canoe. In the middle, a tattered pavilion covered an empty dais where a throne might once have sat. A single mast held a square sail that had once been decorated, but was now faded and hanging in shreds. Port and starboard, sets of broken oars dangled uselessly. The boat must have been abandoned for centuries. The rigging was covered in cobwebs, the lines were rotten, the planks of the hull groaned and creaked as the boat picked up speed.
"It is old, like Ra," Horace said. "Do you really want to put this boat back into service? Let me show you the threat you face."
The rudder turned us into the current. Suddenly we were racing downstream. I'd sailed on the River of Night before, but this time we seemed to be much deeper in the Duat. The air was colder, the rapids faster. We jumped a cataract and went airborne. When we splashed down again, monsters began attacking. Horrible faces rose up. A sea dragon with feline eyes, a crocodile with porcupine bristles, a serpent with the head of a mummified man. Each time one rose up, I raised my sword and cut it down, or speared it with my javelin to keep it away from the boat. But they just kept coming, changing forms, and I knew that if I hadn't been Horace the Avenger, if I had just been Carter Kane trying to deal with these horrors, I would go crazy, or die, or both.
"Every night, this was the journey," Horace said. "It was not Ra who fended off the creatures of chaos. We other gods kept him safe. We held back Apophis and his minions."
We plunged over another waterfall and crashed headlong into a whirlpool. Somehow, we managed not to capsize. The boat spun out of the current and floated toward the shore. The riverbank here was a field of glistening black stones. Or so I thought. As we got closer, I realized they were bug shells. Millions and millions of dried-up beetle carapaces, stretching into the gloom as far as I could see. A few living scarabs moved sluggishly among the empty shells, so it seemed like the whole landscape was crawling. I'm not even going to try to describe the smell of several million dead dung beetles.
"The serpent's prison," Horace said.
I scanned the darkness for a jail cell, chains, a pit, or something. All I saw was an endless expanse of dead beetles. "Where?" I asked.
"I am showing you this place in a way you can understand," Horace said. "If you were here in person, you would burn to ashes. If you saw this place as it really is, your limited mortal senses would melt."
"Great," I muttered. "I just love having my senses melted." The boat scraped against the shore, stirring up a few live scarabs. The whole beach seemed to squirm and writhe.
"Once, all these scarabs were alive," Horace said, "the symbol of Ra's daily rebirth, holding back the enemy. Now only a few remain. The serpent slowly devours his way out.
Wait, I said. You mean... In front of me, the shoreline swelled as something underneath pushed upward, a vast shape straining to break free. I gripped my sword and javelin, but even with all the strength and courage of Horus, I found myself trembling. Red light glowed beneath the scarab shells. They crackled and shifted as the thing below surged toward the surface. Through the thinning layer of dead bugs, a 10-foot-wide red circle stared up at me. A serpent's eye, full of hatred and hunger. Even in my godly form, I felt the power of chaos washing over me like lethal radiation, cooking me from the inside out, eating into my soul. And I believed what Horus had said. If I were here in the flesh, I would be burned to ashes. It's breaking free. My throat started closing up with panic. Horus, it's getting out!
Yes, he said. Soon.
Horus guided my arm. I raised my spear and thrust it into the serpent's eye. Apophis howled with rage. The riverbank trembled. Then Apophis sank beneath the dead scarab shells, and the red glow faded.
But not today, Horus said. On the equinox, the bonds will weaken enough for the serpent to break free at last. Become my avatar again, Carter. Help me lead the gods into battle. Together, we may be able to stop the rise of Apophis. But if you awaken Ra, and he takes back the throne, will he have the strength to rule? Is this boat in any shape to sail the Duat again?
Why did you help me find the scroll, then? I asked. If you don't want Ra awakened, it must be your choice, Horus said. I believe in you, Carter Kane. Whatever you decide, I will support you. But many of the other gods do not feel the same. They think our chances would be better with me as their king and general, leading them into battle against the serpent. They see your plan to awaken Ra as foolish and dangerous. It is all I can do to prevent open rebellion. I may not be able to stop them from attacking you and trying to prevent you.
Just what we need, I said. More enemies.
It does not have to be that way, Horus said. Now you have seen the enemy. Who do you think has the best chance to stand against the Lord of Chaos? Ra or Horus?
The boat pushed away from the dark shore.
Horus released my Ba, and my consciousness floated back to the mortal world like a helium balloon. The rest of the night, I dreamed about a landscape of dead scarabs and a red eye glaring from the depths of a weakening prison. If I acted a little shaken up the next morning, now you know why. I spent a lot of time wondering why Horus had showed me that vision. The obvious answer? Horus was now king of the gods. He didn't want Ra coming back to challenge his authority. Gods tend to be selfish. Even when they're helpful, they always have their own motives. That's why you have to be careful about trusting them. On the other hand, Horus had a point. Ra had been old 5,000 years ago. No one knew what kind of shape he was in now. Even if we managed to wake him, there was no guarantee he would help. If he looked as bad as his boat, I didn't see how Ra could defeat Apophis. Horus had asked me who stood the best chance against the Lord of Chaos. Scary truth? When I searched my heart, the answer was none of us. Not the gods, not the magicians, not even all of us working together. Horus wanted to be the king and lead the gods into battle, but this enemy was more powerful than anything he'd ever faced. Apophis was as ancient as the universe, and he only feared one enemy, Ra. Bringing Ra back might not work, but my instincts told me it was our only shot. And frankly, the fact that everyone kept telling me it was a bad idea, Bast, Horus, even Sadie, made me more certain it was the right thing to do. I'm kind of stubborn that way. The right choice is hardly ever the easy choice, my dad had often told me. Dad had defied the entire house of life. He'd sacrificed his own life to unleash the gods because he was sure it was the only way to save the world. Now it was time for me to make the difficult choice. Fast forward past breakfast and my argument with Sadie. After she jumped through the portal, I stayed on the roof with no company but my new friend, the psychotic Griffin. He screamed, "Freak!" so much that I decided to call him Freak. Plus, it fit his personality. I'd expected him to disappear overnight, to either fly away or return to the Duat, but he seemed happy in his new roost. I'd feathered it with a stack of morning newspapers, all of them featuring headlines about the bizarre sewer gas eruption that had swept through Brooklyn the night before. According to the reports, the gas had ignited ghostly fires across the borough, caused extensive damage at the museum, and overwhelmed some people with nausea, dizziness, and even hallucinations of rhinoceros-sized hummingbirds. Stupid sewer gas. I was tossing Freak more roasted turkeys. Jeez, he had an appetite, when Bost appeared next to me.
"Normally, I enjoy birds," she said, "but that thing is disturbing."
"Freak!"
said Freak. He and Bost regarded each other as if each was wondering what the other would taste like for lunch. Bost sniffed.
"You're not going to keep it, are you?"
"Well, he's not tied up or anything," I said. "He could leave if he wanted to. I think he likes it here."
"Wonderful," Bost muttered. "One more thing that might kill you while I'm gone."
Personally, I thought Freak and I were getting along pretty well, but I figured nothing I said would reassure Bost. She was dressed for travel. Over her usual leopard-skin bodysuit, she wore a long black coat embroidered with protective hieroglyphs. When she moved, the fabric shimmered, making her fade in and out of sight. "Be careful," I told her. She smiled.
"I'm a cat, Carter. I can look after myself. I'm more worried about you and Sadie while I'm gone. If your vision is accurate and Apophis's prison is close to breaking, well, I'll be back as soon as I can."
There wasn't much I could say to that. If my vision was accurate, we were all in deep trouble.
"I may be out of touch for a couple of days," she continued. "My friend should get here before you and Sadie leave on your quest tomorrow. He'll make sure you two stay alive."
"Can't you at least tell me his name?" Bost gave me a look that was either amused or nervous. Possibly both.
"He's a little hard to explain. I'd better let him introduce himself."
With that, Bost kissed me on the forehead.
"Take care, my kit."
I was too stunned to respond. I thought of Bost as Sadie's protector. I was just kind of an add-on. But her voice held such affection, I probably blushed. She ran to the edge of the roof and jumped. I wasn't worried about her, though. I was pretty sure she'd land on her feet. I wanted to keep things as normal as possible for the trainees, so I led my usual morning class. I called it Magic Problem Solving 101. The trainees called it Whatever Works. I gave the trainees a problem. They could solve it any way they wanted. As soon as they succeeded, they could go. I guess this wasn't much like real school, where you have to stay until the end of the day even if you're just doing busy work, but I'd never been to a real school. All those years homeschooling with my dad, I'd learned at my own pace. When I finished my assignments to my dad's satisfaction, the school day was over. The system worked for me, and the trainees seemed to like it, too. I also thought Zia Rashid would approve. The first time Sadie and I trained with Zia, She told us that magic couldn't be learned from classrooms and textbooks. You had to learn by doing. So for Magic Problem Solving 101, we headed to the training room and blew stuff up. Today, I had 4 students. The rest of the trainees would be off researching their own paths of magic, practicing enchantments, or doing regular schoolwork under the supervision of our college-age initiates. As our main adult chaperone while Amos was gone, Bost had insisted we keep everyone up to speed on the regular subjects like math and reading, although she did sometimes add her own elective courses, such as advanced cat grooming or napping. There was a waiting list to get into napping. Anyway, the training room took up most of the second floor. It was about the size of a basketball court, which is what we used it for in the evenings. It had a hardwood floor, god statues lining the walls, and a vaulted ceiling with pictures of ancient Egyptians rocking that sideways walk they always do. On the baseline walls, we'd stuck falcon-headed statues of Ra perpendicular to the floor, 10 feet up, and hollowed out their sun disc crowns so we could use them as basketball hoops. Probably blasphemous, but hey, if Ra didn't have a sense of humor, that was his problem. Walt was waiting for me, along with Julian, Felix, and Alyssa. Jazz almost always showed up for these sessions, but of course, Jazz was still in a coma. And that was a problem none of us knew how to solve. I attempted to put on my confident teacher face. Okay, guys, today we'll try some combat simulations. We'll start simple. I pulled 4 Shabti figurines from my bag and placed them in different corners of the room. I stationed 1 trainee in front of each. Then I spoke a command word. The 4 statuettes grew into full-size Egyptian warriors armed with swords and shields. They weren't super realistic. Their skin looked like glazed ceramic, and they moved slower than real humans. But they'd be good enough for starters. "Felix," I called. "No penguins." "Aw, come on!" Felix believed that the answer to every problem involved penguins. But it wasn't fair to the birds, and I was getting tired of teleporting them back home. Somewhere in Antarctica, a whole flock of Magellanic penguins was undergoing psychotherapy. "Begin!" I yelled, and the Shabti attacked. Julian, a big 7th grader who'd already decided on the path of Horus, went straight into battle. He hadn't quite mastered summoning a combat avatar, but he encased his fist in golden energy like a wrecking ball and punched the Shabti. It flew backward into the wall, cracking to pieces. 1 down. Alyssa had been studying the path of Geb, the Earth God. Nobody at Brooklyn House was an expert in Earth magic, but Alyssa rarely needed help. She'd grown up in a family of potters in North Carolina and had been working with clay since she was a little girl. She dodged the Shabti's clumsy swing and touched it on the back. A hieroglyph glowed against its clay armor. Nothing seemed to happen to the warrior, but when it turned to strike, Alyssa just stood there. I was about to yell at her to duck, but the Shabti missed her completely. Its blade hit the floor, and the warrior stumbled. It attacked again, swinging 6 times, but its blade never got close to Alyssa. Finally, the warrior turned in confusion and staggered to the corner of the room, where it banged its head against the wall and shuddered to a stop. Alyssa grinned at me. "Sapair," she explained. "Hieroglyph for miss." "Nice one," I said. Meanwhile, Felix found a non-penguin solution. I had no idea what type of magic he might eventually specialize in, but today he went for simple and violent. He grabbed a basketball from the bench, waited for the Shabti to take a step, then bounced the ball off its head. His timing was perfect. The Shabti lost its balance and fell over, its sword arm cracking off. Felix walked over and stomped on the Shabti until it broke to pieces. He looked at me with satisfaction. "You didn't say we had to use magic." Fair enough. I made a mental note never to play basketball with Felix. Walt was the most interesting to watch. He was a sow, a charm maker, so he tended to fight with whatever magic items he had on hand. I never knew what he was going to do. As for his path, Walt hadn't decided which god's magic to study. He was a good researcher like Toth, the god of knowledge. He could use scrolls and potions almost as well as Sadie, so he could have chosen the path of Isis. He might have even chosen Osiris because Walt was a natural at bringing inanimate things to life. Today, he was taking his time, fingering his amulets and considering his options. As the Shabti approached, Walt retreated. If Walt had a weakness, it was his cautiousness. He liked to think a long time before he acted. In other words, he was Sadie's exact opposite. "Don't punch me, Sadie! It's true!" "Come on, Walt!" Julian called. "Kill it already!" "You've got this," Alyssa said. Walt reached for one of his rings. Then he stepped backward and stumbled over the shards of Felix's broken Shabti. I shouted, "Look out!" But Walt slipped and fell hard. His Shabti opponent rushed forward, slashing down with its sword. I raced to help, but I was too far away. Walt's hand was already rising instinctively to block the strike. The enchanted ceramic blade was almost as sharp as real metal. It should have hurt Walt pretty badly, but he grabbed it, and the Shabti froze. Under Walt's fingers, the blade turned gray and became webbed with cracks. The gray spread like frost over the entire warrior, and the Shabti crumbled into a pile of dust. Walt looked stunned. He opened his hand, which was perfectly fine. "That was cool," Felix said. "What amulet was that?" Walt gave me a nervous glance, and I knew the answer. It wasn't an amulet. Walt had no idea how he'd done it. That would have been enough excitement for one day, seriously, but the weirdness was just beginning. Before either of us could say anything, the floor shook. I thought maybe Walt's magic was spreading into the building, which wouldn't have been good, or maybe someone below us was experimenting with exploding donkey curses again. Alyssa yelped, "Gaz!" She pointed to the statue of Ra jutting out from the wall, 10 feet above us. Our godly basketball hoop was crumbling. At first, I wasn't sure what I was seeing. The Ra statue wasn't turning to dust like the Shabti. It was breaking apart, falling to the floor in pieces. Then my stomach clenched. The pieces weren't stone. The statue was turning into scarab shells. The last of the statue crumbled away, and the pile of dung beetle husks began to move. 3 serpent heads rose from the center. I don't mind telling you, I panicked. I thought my vision of Apophis was coming true right then and there. I stumbled back so quickly I ran into Alyssa. The only reason I didn't bolt from the room was because 4 trainees were looking to me for reassurance. It can't be Apophis, I told myself. The snakes emerged, and I realized they weren't 3 different animals. It was 1 massive cobra with 3 heads. Even weirder, it unfurled a pair of hawk-like wings. The thing's trunk was as thick as my leg. It stood as tall as me, but it wasn't nearly big enough to be Apophis. Its eyes weren't glowing red. They were regular, creepy, green snake eyes. Still, with all 3 heads staring right at me, I can't say I relaxed. Carter? Felix asked uneasily. Is this part of the lesson? The serpent hissed in 3-part harmony. Its voice seemed to speak inside my head, and it sounded exactly like the bow in the Brooklyn Museum.
Your last warning, Carter Kane,
it said.
Give me the scroll.
My heart skipped a beat. The scroll. Sadie had given it to me after breakfast. Stupid me, I should have locked it up, put it in one of our secure cubbyholes in the library, but it was still in the bag on my shoulder. What are you? I asked the snake. Carter? Julian drew his sword. Do we attack? My trainees gave no indication that they'd heard either the snake or me speak. Alyssa raised her hands like she was ready to catch a dodgeball. Walt positioned himself between the snake and Felix leaned sideways to see around him.
Give it to me.
The serpent coiled to strike, crushing dead beetle shells under its body. Its wings spread so wide they could have wrapped around us all.
Give up your quest, or I will destroy the girl you seek, just as I destroyed her village.
I tried to draw my sword, but my arms wouldn't move. I felt paralyzed, as if those three sets of eyes had put me into a trance. Her village, I thought. Zia's village. Snakes can't laugh, but this thing's hiss sounded amused.
You'll have to make a choice, Carter Kane. The girl or the god. Abandon your foolish quest, or soon you'll be just another dry husk, like Ra's scarabs.
My anger saved me. I shook off the paralysis and yelled, "Kill it!" just as a serpent opened its mouths, blasting out three columns of flames. I raised a green shield of magic to deflect the fire. Julian chucked his sword like a throwing axe. Alyssa gestured with her hand, and three stone statues leaped off their pedestals, flying at the serpent. Walt fired a bolt of gray light from his wand, and Felix took off his left shoe and lobbed it at the monster. Right about then, it sucked to be the serpent. Julian's sword sliced off one of its heads. Felix's shoe bounced off another. The blast from Walt's wand turned the third to dust. Then Alyssa's statue slammed into it, smashing the monster under a ton of stone. What was left of the serpent's body dissolved into sand. The room was suddenly quiet. My four trainees looked at me. I reached down and picked up one of the scarab shells. "Carter, that was part of the lesson, right?" Felix asked. "Tell me that was part of the lesson." I thought about the serpent's voice, the same voice as the boughs in the Brooklyn Museum. I realized why it sounded so familiar. I'd heard it before during the battle at the Red Pyramid. "Carter?" Felix looked like he was about to cry. He was such a troublemaker, I sometimes forgot he was only 9 years old. "Yes, just a test," I lied. I looked at Walt and we came to a silent agreement. We need to talk about this later. But first, I had someone else to question. Class dismissed. I ran to find Amos. 6. A birdbath almost kills me. Amos turned the scarab shell in his fingers.
"A three-headed snake, you say?"
I felt guilty dumping this on him. He'd been through so much since Christmas. Then he finally got healed and came home, and boom, a monster invades our practice room. But I didn't know who else to talk to. I was kind of sorry Sadie wasn't around. "All right, Sadie, don't gloat. I wasn't that sorry." "Yeah," I said, "with wings and flamethrower breath. Ever seen something like that before?" Amos put the scarab shell on the table. He nudged it as if expecting it to come to life. We had the library to ourselves, which was unusual. Often the big round chamber was filled with trainees hunting through rows of cubbyholes for scrolls, or sending retrieval Shabti across the world for artifacts, books, or pizza. Painted on the floor was a picture of Geb, the earth god, his body dotted with trees and rivers. Above us, the starry-skinned sky goddess Nut stretched across the ceiling. I usually felt safe in this room, sheltered between two gods who'd been friendly to us in the past. But now I kept glancing at the retrieval Shabti stationed around the library and wondering if they would dissolve into scarab shells or decide to attack us. Finally, Amos spoke a command word. "Amox. Burn." A small red hieroglyph blazed over the scarab. The shell burst into flames and crumbled to a tiny mound of ash.
I seem to recall a painting, Amos said, in the tomb of Thutmose III. It showed a three-headed winged snake like the one you described, but what it means... He shook his head. Snakes can be good or bad in Egyptian legend. They can be the enemies of Ra, or his protectors. This wasn't a protector, I said. It wanted the scroll. And yet it had three heads, which might symbolize the three aspects of Ra. And it was born from the rubble of Ra's statue.
It wasn't from Ra, I insisted. Why would Ra want to stop us from finding him? Besides, I recognized the snake's voice. It was the voice of your... I bit my tongue. I mean, it was the voice of Set's minion from the Red Pyramid, the one who was possessed by Apophis.
Amos's eyes became unfocused. Face of horror, he remembered. You think Apophis was speaking to you through this serpent?
I nodded. I think he set those traps at the Brooklyn Museum. He spoke to me through that bough. If he's so powerful that he can infiltrate this mansion, no, Carter. Even if you're right, it wasn't Apophis himself. If he'd broken out of his prison, it would cause ripples through the Duat so powerful, every magician would feel them. But possessing the minds of minions, even sending them into protected places to deliver a message, that's much easier. I don't think that snake could have done you much harm. It would have been quite weak after breaching our defenses. It was mostly sent to warn you and scare you.
It worked, I said.
I didn't ask Amos how he knew so much about possession and the ways of chaos. Having had his body taken over by Set, the god of evil, had given him an intensive crash course in stuff like that. Now he seemed back to normal, but I knew from my own experience of sharing a mind with Horus, once you hosted a god, whether it was voluntary or not, you were never quite the same. You retained the memories, even some traces of the god's power. I couldn't help noticing that the color of Amos's magic had changed. It used to be blue. Now, when he summoned hieroglyphs, they glowed red, the color of Set.
I'll strengthen the charms around the house, he promised. It's high time I upgraded our security. I'll make sure Apophis can't send messengers through again.
I nodded, but his promise didn't make me feel much better. Tomorrow, if Sadie came back safely, we'd be off on a quest to find the other two scrolls for the Book of Ra. Sure, we'd survived our last adventure fighting Set, but Apophis was in a totally different league, and we weren't hosting gods anymore. We were just kids, facing evil magicians, demons, monsters, spirits, and the eternal lord of chaos. In the plus column, I had a cranky sister, a sword, a baboon, and a griffin with a personality disorder. I wasn't liking those odds.
Amos, I said, what if we're wrong? What if awakening Ra doesn't work?
It had been a long time since I'd seen my uncle smile. He didn't look much like my father, but when he smiled, he got the same crinkles around his eyes.
My boy, look what you've accomplished. You and Sadie have rediscovered a way of magic that hasn't been practiced in millennia. You've taken your trainees further in 2 months than most first gnome initiates would get in 2 years. You've battled gods. You've accomplished more than any living magician has, even me, even Michel Desjardins. Trust your instincts. If I were a betting man, my money would be on you and your sister every time.
A lump formed in my throat. I hadn't gotten a pep talk like that since my dad was still alive, and I guess I hadn't realized how much I needed one. Unfortunately, hearing Desjardins' name reminded me that we had other problems besides Apophis. As soon as we started our quest, a magical Russian ice cream salesman named Vlad the Inhaler was going to try to assassinate us. And if Vlad was the third most powerful magician in the world...
Who's second?
I asked. Amos frowned. What do you mean?
You said this Russian guy, Vlad Menshikov, is the third most powerful magician alive. Desjardins is the most powerful. So who's second? I want to know if we have another enemy to look out for.
The idea seemed to amuse Amos.
Don't worry about that. And despite your past dealings with Desjardins, I would not say he's truly an enemy.
Tell him that, I muttered.
I did, Carter.
We talked several times while I was at the first gnome. I think what you and Sadie accomplished at the Red Pyramid shook him deeply. He knows he could not have defeated Set without you. He still opposes you, but if we had more time, I might be able to convince him.
That sounded about as likely as Apophis and Ra becoming Facebook buddies, but I decided not to say anything.
Amos passed his hand over the tabletop and spoke a spell. A red holograph of Ra appeared, a miniature replica of the statue in the practice room. The sun god looked like Horus, a falcon-headed man. But unlike Horus, Ra wore the sun disk as a crown and held a shepherd's crook and a war flail, the two symbols of the pharaoh. He was dressed in robes rather than armor, sitting calmly and regally on his throne as if he were happy to watch others do the fighting. The god's image looked strange in red, glowing with the color of chaos.
"Something else you must consider," Amos warned.
"I don't say this to discourage you, but you asked why Ra might want to stop you from waking him. The Book of Ra was divided for a reason. It was made intentionally difficult to find, so only the worthy would succeed. You should expect challenges and obstacles on your quest. The other two scrolls will be at least as well protected as the first, and you should ask yourself, what happens if you wake a god who does not want to be awakened?"
The doors of the library banged open, and I almost jumped out of my chair. Cleo and three other girls came in, chatting and laughing with their arms full of scrolls.
"Here's my research class." Amos flicked his hand, and the holograph of Ra disappeared.
"We'll speak again, Carter. Perhaps after lunch."
I nodded, though even then I had a suspicion we'd never get to finish our conversation.
When I looked back from the door of the library, Amos was greeting his students, casually wiping the ashes of the scarab shell off the table. I got to my room and found Hufu crashed on the bed, surfing the sports channels. He was wearing his favorite Lakers jersey and had a bowl of Cheetos on his stomach. Ever since our trainees moved in, the great room had gotten too noisy for Hufu to watch TV in peace, so he decided to become my roommate. I guess it was a compliment, but sharing space with a baboon wasn't easy. You think dogs and cats shed? Try getting monkey hair off your clothes.
"What's up?" I asked.
"Ugh!"
That's pretty much what he always said.
"Great," I told him. "I'll be on the balcony." It was still cold and rainy outside. The wind off the East River would have made Felix's penguins shiver, but I didn't mind. For the first time that day, I could finally be alone. Since our trainees had come to Brooklyn House, I felt like I was always on stage. I had to act confident, even when I had doubts. I couldn't lose my temper with anybody, well, except Sadie, once in a while. And when things went wrong, I couldn't complain too loudly. The other kids had come long distances to train with us. Many of them had fought monsters or magicians on the way. I couldn't admit I had no idea what I was doing, or wonder aloud whether this Path of the Gods thing was going to get us all killed. I couldn't say, now that you're here, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. But there were plenty of times when that was how I felt. With Hufu occupying my room, the balcony was the only place I could be depressed in solitude. I looked across the river to Manhattan. It was a great view. When Sadie and I had first arrived at Brooklyn House, Amos had told us that magicians tried to stay out of Manhattan. He said Manhattan had other problems, whatever that meant. And sometimes when I looked across the water, I could swear I was seeing things.
Sadie laughed about it, but once I thought I saw a flying horse. Probably just the mansion's magic barriers causing optical illusions, but still, it was weird. I turned to the only piece of furniture on the balcony, my scrying bowl. It looked like a birdbath, just a bronze saucer on a stone pedestal. But it was my favorite magic item. Walt had made it for me right after he had arrived. One day I'd mentioned how nice it would be to know what was going on in the other gnomes, and he'd made me this bowl. I'd seen initiates use them in the first gnome, but they'd always seemed pretty difficult to master. Fortunately, Walt was an expert with enchantments. If my scrying bowl had been a car, it would have been a Cadillac, with power steering, automatic transmission, and a butt warmer. All I had to do was fill it with clean olive oil and speak the command word. The bowl would show me anything, as long as I could visualize it and it wasn't shielded by magic. Places I'd never been to were hard to see. People or places that I'd seen personally or that meant a lot to me, those were usually easy. I'd searched for Zia 100 times, with no luck. All I knew was that her old mentor, Iskander, had put her into a magical sleep and hidden her somewhere, replacing her with a Shabti to keep her safe. But I had no idea where the real Zia was sleeping. I tried something new. I passed my hand over the saucer and imagined the place of red sands. Nothing happened. I'd never been there, had no idea what it looked like apart from possibly being red and sandy. The oil showed me only my own reflection. Okay, so I couldn't see Zia. I did the next best thing. I concentrated on her secret room in the first gnome. I'd been there only once, but I remembered every detail. It was the first place where I'd felt close to Zia. The surface of the oil rippled and became a magical video feed. Nothing had changed in the room. Magic candles still burned on the little table. The walls were covered with Zia's photographs, pictures of her family village on the Nile, her mother and father, Zia as a small child. Zia had told me the story of how her father had unearthed an Egyptian relic and accidentally unleashed a monster on their village. Magicians came to defeat the monster, but not before the entire town was destroyed. Only Zia, hidden by her parents, had survived. Iskander, the old chief lector, had taken her to the first gnome and trained her. He'd been like a father to her. Then, last Christmas, the gods had been unleashed at the British Museum. One of them, Nephthys, had chosen Zia as a host. Being a godling was punishable by death in the first gnome, whether you meant to host the god's spirit or not. So Iskander had hidden Zia away. He'd probably meant to bring her back after he sorted things out, but he had died before that could happen. So the Zia I'd known was a replica. But I had to believe the Shabti and the real Zia had shared thoughts. Wherever the real Zia was, she would remember me when she woke up. She'd know that we shared a connection, maybe the start of a great relationship. I couldn't accept that I'd fallen in love with nothing but a piece of pottery. And I definitely couldn't accept that Zia was beyond my power to rescue. I concentrated on the image in the oil. I zoomed in on a photograph of Zia riding on her father's shoulders. She was young in the photo, but you could tell she was going to be beautiful when she grew up. Her glossy black hair was cut in a short wedge, as it had been when I knew her. Her eyes were brilliant amber. The photographer had caught her mid-laugh, trying to cover her dad's eyes with her hands. Her smile radiated playful mischief.
"I will destroy the girl you seek,"
the three-headed snake had said,
"just as I destroyed her village."
I was sure he meant Zia's village, but what did that attack 6 years ago have to do with Apophis's rising now? If it hadn't been just a random accident, if Apophis had meant to destroy Zia's home, then why? I had to find Zia, It wasn't just personal anymore. She was connected somehow to the coming battle with Apophis. And if the snake's warning was true, if I had to choose between finding the Book of Ra and saving Zia, well, I'd already lost my mom, my dad, and my old life for the sake of stopping Apophis. I wasn't going to lose Zia, too. I was contemplating how hard Sadie would kick me if she heard me say that, when somebody knocked on the balcony's glass door.
Hey.
Walt stood in the doorway, holding Hufu's hand.
Hope you don't mind. Hufu let me in.
Ugh!
Hufu confirmed. He led Walt outside, then jumped on the railing, disregarding the 100-foot drop to the river below. No problem, I said. Not like I had a choice. Hufu loved Walt, probably because he played basketball better than I did. Walt nodded at the scrying ball.
How's that working for you?
The image of Zia's room still shimmered in the oil. I waved my hand over the bowl and changed it to something else. Since I'd been thinking about Sadie, I picked Gran and Gramps' living room. Working fine, I turned back to Walt. How are you feeling? For some reason, his whole body tensed. He looked at me like I was trying to corner him.
What do you mean?
The training room incident? The three-headed snake? What did you think I meant? The tendons in his neck relaxed.
Right. Sorry. Just a weird morning. Did Amos have an explanation?
I wondered what I'd said to upset him, but I decided to let it pass. I filled him in on my conversation with Amos. Walt was usually pretty calm about stuff. He was a good listener, but he still seemed guarded, on edge. When I was done talking, he stepped over to the railing where Hufu was perched.
Apophis let that thing loose in the house? If we hadn't stopped it...
Amos thinks the serpent didn't have much power. It was just here to deliver a message and scare us.
Walt shook his head in dismay. Well, now it knows our abilities, I guess. It knows Felix throws a mean shoe.
I couldn't help but smile. Yeah, except that wasn't the ability I was thinking of. That gray light you blasted the snake with. And the way you handled the Shabti practice dummy, turning it to dust.
How did I do it?
Walt shrugged helplessly.
Honest, Carter, I don't know. I've been thinking about it ever since, and it was just instinctive. At first I thought maybe the Shabti had some kind of self-destruct spell built into it, and I accidentally triggered it. Sometimes I can do that with magic items, cause them to activate or shut down.
But that wouldn't explain how you did it again with the serpent.
No, he agreed.
He seemed more distracted by the incident than I was. Hufu started grooming Walt's hair, looking for bugs, and Walt didn't even try to stop him. Walt, I hesitated, not wanting to push him. This new ability, turning things to dust, it wouldn't have anything to do with, you know, whatever you were telling Jazz.
There it was again, that caged animal look.
I know, I said quickly, it's none of my business, but you've been acting upset lately. If there's anything I can do... He stared down at the river. He looked so depressed, Hufu grunted and patted him on the shoulder.
Sometimes I wonder why I came here, Walt said.
Are you kidding? I asked. You're great at magic. One of the best. You've got a future here. He pulled something out of his pocket, one of the dried-up scarabs from the practice room.
Thanks, but the timing... It's like a bad joke. Things are complicated for me, Carter, and the future... I don't know.
I got the feeling he was talking about more than our 4-day deadline to save the world. Look, if there's a problem, I said, if it's something about the way Sadie and I are teaching...
Of course not, you've been great. And Sadie,
she likes you a lot, I said. I know she can come on a little strong. If you want her to back off... Okay, Sadie, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But you aren't exactly subtle when you like somebody. I figured it might be making the guy uncomfortable.
Walt actually laughed. No, it's nothing about Sadie. I like her too. I'm just... Ugh!
Hufu barked so loudly it made me jump. He bared his fangs. I turned and realized that he was snarling at the scrying bowl. The scene was still Gran and Gramps' living room, but as I studied it more closely, I realized something was wrong. The lights and TV were off. The sofa had been tipped over. I got a metallic taste in my mouth. I concentrated on shifting the image until I could see the front door. It had been smashed to pieces. "What's wrong?" Walt came up next to me. "What is it?" "Sadie." I focused all my willpower on finding her. I knew her so well that I could usually locate her instantly, but this time the oil turned black. A sharp pain stabbed behind my eyes, and the surface of the oil erupted in flames. Walt pulled me back before my face could get burned. Hufu barked an alarm and tipped the bronze saucer over the railing, sending it hurtling toward the East River. "What happened?" Walt asked. "I've never seen a bowl do... Portal to London," I coughed, my nostrils stinging with burned olive oil. "Nearest one, now!" Walt seemed to understand. His expression hardened with resolve. "Our portal's still on cooldown. We'll need to go back to the Brooklyn Museum." "The Griffin," I said. "Yeah, I'm coming too." I turned to Hufu. "Go tell Amos we're leaving. Sadie's in trouble. No time to explain." Hufu barked and leaped straight over the side of the balcony, taking the express elevator down. Walt and I bolted from my room, racing up the stairs to the roof.
7. A gift from the dog-headed boy.
"Well, you talked long enough, brother dear. As you've been babbling on, everyone's been imagining me frozen in the doorway of Gran and Gramp's flat, screaming, "Ah!" And the fact that you and Walt bolted off to London, assuming I needed to be rescued? Men. Yes, fair enough, I did need help, but that's not the point. Back to the story. I just heard a voice hissing from upstairs. "Welcome home, Sadie Kane." Of course, I knew this was bad news. My hands tingled as if I'd stuck my fingers in a light socket. I tried to summon my staff and wand, but as I may have mentioned, I'm rubbish at retrieving things from the Duat on short notice. I cursed myself for not coming prepared, but really, I couldn't have been expected to wear linen pajamas and lug around a magic duffel bag for a night on the town with my mates. I considered fleeing, but Gran and Gramps might be in danger. I couldn't leave without knowing that they were safe. The stairwell creaked. At the top, the hem of a black dress appeared, along with sandaled feet that weren't quite human. The toes were gnarled and leathery, with overgrown nails like a bird's talons. As the woman descended into full view, I made a very undignified whimpering noise. She looked 100 years old, hunched over and emaciated. Her face, earlobes and neck sagged with folds of wrinkly pink skin, as if she'd melted under a sun lamp. Her nose was a drooping beak. Her eyes gleamed in their cavernous sockets, and she was almost bald, just a few greasy black tufts like weeds pushing through her craggy scalp. Her dress, however, was absolutely plush. It was midnight black, fluffy and huge, like a fur coat 6 sizes too big. As she stepped toward me, the material shifted, and I realized that it wasn't fur. The dress was made from black feathers. Her hands appeared from her sleeves, claw-like fingers beckoning me forward. Her smile revealed teeth like broken bits of glass. And did I mention the smell? Not just old person smell, old dead person smell.
"I've been waiting for you," said the hag. "Fortunately, I'm very patient."
I grasped the air for my wand. Of course, I had no luck. Without Isis in my head, I couldn't simply speak words of power anymore. I had to have my tools. My only chance was to stall for time and hope I could collect my thoughts enough to access the Duat. "Who are you?" I asked. "Where are my grandparents?"
The hag reached the foot of the stairs. From 2 meters away, her feathery dress appeared to be covered with bits of... Egad, was that meat?
Don't you recognize me, dear?
Her image flickered. Her dress turned into a flowered housecoat. Her sandals became fuzzy green slippers. She had curly grey hair, watery blue eyes, and the expression of a startled rabbit. It was Grandmother's face.
Sadie?
Her voice sounded weak and confused. Gran! Her image changed back to the black-feathered hag, her horrible melted face grinning maliciously.
Yes, dear. Your family is blood of the pharaohs, after all. Perfect hosts for the gods. Don't make me strain myself, though. Your grandmother's heart isn't what it used to be.
My whole body began to shake. I'd seen possession before, and it was always hideous. But this, the idea of some Egyptian hag taking over my poor old gran, this was horrifying. If I had any blood of the pharaohs, it was turning to ice.
Leave her alone!
I meant to shout, but I'm afraid my voice was more of a terrified squeak.
Get out of her!
The hag cackled.
Oh, I can't do that. You see, Sadie Kane, some of us doubt your strength.
Some of who? The gods?
Her face rippled, momentarily changing into a horrible bird's head, bald and scaly pink with a long, sharp beak. Then she morphed back into the grinning hag. I really wished she would make up her mind.
I don't bother the strong, Sadie Kane. In the old days, I even protected the pharaoh if he proved himself worthy. But the weak, once they fall under the shadow of my wings, I never let them go. I wait for them to die. I wait to feed. And I think, my dear, that you will be my next meal.
I pressed my back to the door. I know you, I lied. Frantically, I ran down my mental list of Egyptian gods, trying to place the old hag. I still wasn't half as good as Carter at remembering all those odd names. And no, Carter, that's not a compliment. It simply means you're a bigger nerd. But after weeks of teaching our trainees, I'd gotten better. Names held power. If I could figure out my enemy's name, that was a good first step to defeating her. A grisly black bird. A bird that feeds on the dead. To my amazement, I actually remembered something.
You're the vulture goddess, I said triumphantly. Neck-butt, is it?
The old hag snarled.
Neck-butt!
All right, so I was close.
But you're supposed to be a good goddess, I protested.
The goddess spread her arms. They turned into wings, black matted plumage buzzing with flies and smelling of death.
Vultures are very good, Sadie Kane. We remove the sickly and weak. We circle them until they die, then feed on their carcasses, cleaning the world of their stench. You, on the other hand, would bring back Ra, that wizened old carcass of a sun god. You would place a weak pharaoh on the throne of the gods. It goes against nature. Only the strong should live. The dead should be eaten.
Her breath smelled like roadkill. Despicable creatures, vultures, without a doubt the most disgusting birds ever. I suppose they served their purpose, but did they have to be so greasy and ugly? Couldn't we have cute, fuzzy rabbits that cleaned up roadkill instead? Right, I said. First, get out of my gran. Then, if you're a good vulture, I'll buy you some breath mints. This must have been a sore subject for Necbet. She lunged at me. I dove sideways, clambering over the couch and tipping it in the process. Necbet swept Gran's china collection off the sideboard.
"You will die, Sadie Kane," she said. "I will pick clean your bones. Then the other gods will see you were not worthy."
I waited for another attack, but she just glared at me from the other side of the sofa. It occurred to me that vultures don't usually kill. They wait for their prey to die. Necbet's wings filled the room. Her shadow fell over me, wrapping me in darkness. I began to feel trapped, helpless, like a small, sickly animal. If I hadn't tested my will against gods before, I might not have recognized this as magic, this insistent nagging in the back of my mind, urging me to give up in despair. But I'd stood against any number of horrid gods from the underworld. I could handle a greasy old bird. "Nice try," I said, "but I'm not going to lie down and die." Necbet's eyes glittered.
"Perhaps it will take some time, my dear, but as I told you, I'm patient. If you won't succumb, your mortal friends will be here soon. What are their names? Liz and Emma?"
"Leave them out of this!"
"Ah, they'll make lovely appetizers. And you haven't even said hello to dear old Gramps yet."
Blood roared in my ears. "Where is he?" I demanded. Necbet glanced at the ceiling.
"Oh, he'll be along shortly. We vultures like to follow a nice big predator around, you know, and wait for it to do the killing."
From upstairs came a muffled crash, as if a large piece of furniture had been thrown out a window. Gramps shouted,
"No! No!"
Then his voice changed into the roar of a mad animal. The last of my courage melted into my combat boots. "What?"
"Yes," Necbet said. "Bobby is waking."
"Bobby? You've got a god named Bobby?"
"B-A-B-I," the vulture goddess snarled. "You really are quite dense, aren't you, dear?"
The ceiling plaster cracked under the weight of heavy footsteps. Something was tromping toward the stairwell.
"Bobby will take good care of you," Necbet promised, "and there will be plenty left over from me."
"Goodbye," I said, and I bolted for the door. Necbet didn't try to stop me. She shrieked behind me,
"A hunt! Excellent!"
I made it across the street when our front door exploded. Glancing back, I saw something emerge from the ruins and dust, a dark, hairy shape much too big to be my grandfather. I didn't wait for a better look. I raced around the corner of South Colonnade and plowed straight into Liz and Emma.
"Sadie?"
Liz yelped, dropping a birthday present.
"What's wrong?"
"No time," I said. "Come on." "Nice to see you too," Emma grumbled. "Where are you rushing off?" The creature behind me bellowed, quite close now. "Explain later," I said. "Unless you'd like to be ripped apart by a god named Bobby, follow me." Looking back, I can appreciate just what a miserable birthday I was having, but at the time I was too panicked to feel properly sorry for myself. We ran down South Colonnade, the roaring behind us almost drowned out by Liz and Emma's complaining.
"Sadie," Emma said, "is this one of your jokes?"
She'd gotten a bit taller, but still looked much the same, with her oversized glittery glasses and short spiky hair. She wore a black leather miniskirt, a fuzzy pink jumper, and ridiculous platform shoes that she could barely walk in, much less run. Who's that flamboyant rock and roll chap from the 70s? Elton John. If he had an Indian daughter, she might look like Emma. "It's no joke," I promised, "and for God's sake, lose those shoes." Emma looked appalled.
"Do you know how much these cost?"
"Honestly, Sadie," Liz put in, "where are you dragging us to?" She was dressed more sensibly in jeans and trainers, a white top and denim jacket, but she looked just as winded as Emma. Tucked under her arm, my birthday present was getting a bit squashed. Liz was a redhead with lots of freckles, and when she got embarrassed or overexerted herself, her pale face became so flushed her freckles disappeared. Under normal circumstances, Emma and I would have teased her about this, but not today. Behind us, the creature roared again. I looked back, which was a mistake. I faltered to a stop, and my mates ran into me. For a brief moment, I thought, "My God, it's Hufu!" But Hufu wasn't the size of a grizzly bear. He didn't have glittering silver fur, fangs like scimitars, or a look of bloodlust in his eyes. The baboon ravaging Canary Wharf looked like he would eat anything, not just foods ending with an O, and would have no difficulty ripping me limb from limb. The only good news, the activity on the street had momentarily distracted him. Cars swerved to avoid the beast. Pedestrians screamed and ran. The baboon began overturning taxis, smashing shop windows, and causing a general riot. As he got closer to us, I saw a bit of red cloth hanging from his left arm, the remains of Gramps' favorite cardigan. Stuck on his forehead were Gramps' glasses. Until that moment, the shock hadn't fully hit me. That thing was my grandfather, who had never used magic and never done anything to annoy the Egyptian gods. There were times I didn't like my grandparents, especially when they said bad things about my dad or ignored Carter, or when they'd let Amos take me away last Christmas without a fight. But still, they'd raised me for 6 years. Gramps had put me on his lap and read me his dusty old Enid Blyton stories when I was small. He'd watched after me at the park and taken me to the zoo countless times. He'd bought me sweets, even though Gran disapproved. He may have had a temper, but he was a reasonably harmless old pensioner. He certainly didn't deserve to have his body taken over like this. The baboon ripped the door off a pub and sniffed inside. Panicked patrons smashed through a window and ran off down the street, still holding their pints. A policeman ran toward the commotion, saw the baboon, then turned and ran the other way, yelling into his radio for reinforcements. When faced with magical events, mortal eyes tended to short-circuit, sending the brain only images it could understand. I had no idea what these people thought they were seeing, possibly an escaped zoo animal or an enraged gunman, but they knew enough to flee. I wondered what the London security cameras would make of the scene later.
"Sadie?" Liz said in a very small voice. "What is that?"
"Bobby," I said. "The bloody god of baboons! He's taken over my granddad, and he wants to kill us!"
"Excuse me," Emma said. "Did you just say a baboon god wants to kill us?"
The baboon roared, blinking and squinting as if he had forgotten what he was doing. Maybe he'd inherited Gramps' absent-mindedness and bad eyesight. Maybe he didn't realize his glasses were on his head. He sniffed at the ground, then bellowed in frustration and smashed the window of a bakery. I almost believed we'd gotten a bit of good luck. Perhaps we could sneak away. Then a dark shape glided overhead, spreading its black wings and crying, "Here! Here!" Wonderful. The baboon had air support. "Two gods, actually," I told my friends. "Now, unless there are any more questions, run!" This time Liz and Emma needed no encouragement. Emma kicked off her shoes, Liz tossed aside my present, pity that, and we raced one another down the street. We zigzagged through alleyways, hugging walls for cover whenever the vulture goddess swooped overhead. I heard Bobby roaring along behind us, ruining people's evenings and smashing up the neighbourhood, but he seemed to have lost our scent for the moment. We paused at a T in the road while I considered which way to run. In front of us stood a little church, the sort of ancient building you often find in London, a sombre bit of medieval stone wedged between a Cafe Nero and a chemist's shop with neon signs offering selected hair products, 3 for £1. The church had a tiny graveyard enclosed with a rusty fence, but I wouldn't have paid it much attention if a voice inside the yard hadn't whispered, "Sadie!" It's a miracle my heart didn't jump out of my throat. I turned and found myself face to face with Anubis. He was in his mortal form as a teen boy with dark, wind-blown hair and warm brown eyes. He wore a black dead-weather T-shirt and black jeans that fit him extremely well. Liz and Emma are not known for being smooth around good-looking boys. In fact, their brains more or less cease to function.
Liz gasped in single syllables that sounded like Lamar's breathing. What? Emma lost control of her legs and stumbled into me. I shot both of them a harsh look, then turned to Anubis. It's about time someone friendly showed up, I complained. There's a baboon and a vulture trying to kill us. Would you please sort them out? Anubis pursed his lips, and I got the feeling he wasn't there to bring me good news. Come into my territory, he said, opening the graveyard gate. We need to talk, and there isn't much time. Emma stumbled into me again. Your, territory? Liz gulped. Who, shh, I told them, trying to stay composed, as if I met hot guys in graveyards every day. I glanced down the street and saw no sign of Bobby or Neckbet, but I could still hear them, the baboon god roaring, the vulture goddess shrieking in my gran's voice, if my gran had been eating gravel and taking steroids. This way! This way! Wait here, I told my friends, and I stepped inside the gate. Immediately the air turned colder. Mist rose from the soggy ground. The gravestones shimmered, and everything outside the fence went slightly out of focus. Anubis made me feel unbalanced in many ways, of course, but I recognized this effect. We were slipping into the Duat, experiencing the graveyard on two levels at once, Anubis's world and mine. He led me to a crumbling stone sarcophagus and bowed to it respectfully. Beatrice, do you mind if we sit? Nothing happened. The inscription on the sarcophagus had worn away centuries ago, but I supposed this was Beatrice's final resting place. Thank you. Anubis gestured for me to sit. She doesn't mind. What happens if she does mind? I sat down a bit apprehensively. The 18th gnome, Anubis said.
Excuse me?
That's where you must go. Vlad Menshikov has the second section of the Book of Ra in the top drawer of his desk in his headquarters in St. Petersburg. It's a trap, of course. He's hoping to bait you. But if you want the scroll, you've got no choice. You should go tonight, before he has time to strengthen his defences even further. And, Sadie, if the other gods found out I was telling you this, I would be in big trouble.
I stared at him. Sometimes he acted so much like a teenager, it was hard to believe he was thousands of years old. I suppose that came from living a sheltered life in the land of the dead, unaffected by the passage of time. The boy really needed to get out more. You're worried about getting into trouble? I asked. Anubis, not that I'm ungrateful, but I've got bigger problems at the moment. Two gods have possessed my grandparents. If you want to lend a hand...
Sadie, I can't intervene. He turned up his palms in frustration. I told you when we first met, this isn't an actual physical body.
Shame, I mumbled.
What?
Nothing. Go on.
I can manifest in places of death, like this churchyard, but there is very little I can do outside my territory. Now, if you were already dead and you wanted a nice funeral, I could help you, but...
Oh, thanks. Somewhere nearby, the baboon god roared. Glass shattered and bricks crumbled. My friends called to me, but the sounds were distorted and muffled as if I was hearing them from underwater. If I go on without my friends, I asked Anubis, will the gods leave them alone?
Anubis shook his head. Neckbet preys on the weak. She knows that hurting your friends will weaken you. That's why she targeted your grandparents. The only way to stop her is by facing her down. As for Bobby, he represents the darkest qualities of you primates. Murderous rage, uncontrolled strength.
We primates, I said. Sorry, did you just call me a baboon?
Anubis studied me with a kind of confused awe.
I'd forgotten how irritating you are. My point was that he will kill you just for the sake of killing. And you can't help me.
He gave me a mournful look with those gorgeous brown eyes. I told you about St. Petersburg.
Lord, he was good-looking and so annoying. Well then, God of pretty much nothing useful, I said. Anything else before I get myself killed? He held up his hand. A strange sort of knife materialized in his grasp. It was shaped like a Sweeney Todd razor, long, curvy, and wickedly sharp along one edge, made from black metal.
Take this, Anubis said. It will help. Have you seen the size of the baboon? Am I supposed to give him a shave? This is not to fight Bobby or Necbet, he said, but you will need it soon for something even more important. It's a Najiri blade, made from meteoric iron. It's used for a ceremony I once told you about, the opening of the mouth. Yes, well, if I survive the night, I'll be sure to take this razor and open someone's mouth. Thanks ever so much, Liz screamed. Sadie! Through the mist of the graveyard, I saw Bobby a few blocks away, lumbering toward the church. He'd spotted us. Take the underground, Anubis suggested, pulling me to my feet. There's a station half a block south. They won't be able to track you very well below the earth. Running water is also good. Creatures of the Duat are weakened by crossing a river. If you must battle them, find a bridge over the Thames. Oh, and I told your driver to come get you. My driver? Yes, he wasn't planning to meet you until tomorrow, but a red Royal Mail box hurtled through the air and smashed into the building next door. My friends screamed at me to hurry. Go, Anubis said. I'm sorry I can't do more, but happy birthday, Sadie. He leaned forward and kissed me on the lips. Then he melted into mist and disappeared. The graveyard became normal again, part of the regular, unshimmery world. I should have been very cross with Anubis, kissing me without permission, to nerve. But I stood there, paralyzed, staring at Beatrice's crumbling sarcophagus until Emma yelled, Sadie, come on! My friends grabbed my arms and I remembered how to run. We bolted for the Canary Wharf tube station. The baboon roared and smashed through traffic behind us. Overhead, Necbet shrieked, There they go! Kill them! Who was that boy? Emma demanded as we plunged into the station. God, he was hot! A god, I muttered. Yes. I slipped the black razor into my pocket and clambered down the escalator, my lips still tingling from my first kiss. And if I was humming happy birthday and smiling stupidly as I fled for my life, well, that was nobody's business, was it? 8. Major delays at Waterloo Station. We apologize for the giant baboon. The London Underground has lovely acoustics. Sound echoed through the tunnels, so as we descended, I could hear the rush of the trains, the musicians playing for coins, and, of course, the killer baboon god roaring for blood as he pulverized the turnstiles behind us. What with terrorism threats and stepped-up security, one might have expected a few police to be on hand, but sadly not this time of evening, not at such a relatively small station. Sirens through the tunnels, so as we descended, I could hear the rush of the trains, the musicians playing for coins, and, of course, the killer baboon god roaring for blood as he pulverized the turnstiles behind us. What with terrorism threats and stepped-up security, one might have expected a few police to be on hand, but sadly not this time of evening, not at such a relatively small station. Sirens wailed from the street above, but we'd be dead or long gone by the time mortal help arrived. And if the police did try to shoot Bobby while he possessed Gramps' body? No, I forced myself not to think about that. Anubis had suggested travelling underground, and if I had to fight, I should find a bridge. I had to stick with that plan. There wasn't much choice of trains at Canary Wharf. Thankfully, the Jubilee line was running on time. We made it to the platform, jumped aboard the last carriage as the doors were closing, and collapsed on a bench. The train lurched away into the dark tunnel. Behind us, I saw no sign of Bobby or Necbet chasing us. Sadie Kane, Emma gasped. Will you please tell us what's going on? My poor friends. I'd never gotten them into this much trouble, not even when we got shut in the boys' changing room at school. Long story, which involved a 5-quid bet, Dylan Quinn's knickers, and a squirrel. Perhaps I'll tell you later. Emma's feet were cut and blistered from running barefoot. Her pink jumper looked like mangled poodle fur, and her glasses had lost several rhinestones. Lizzie's face was red as a valentine. She'd taken off her denim jacket, which she never does, as she's always cold. Her white top was blotted with sweat. Her arms were so freckly they reminded me of Nut the Sky Goddess's constellation skin.
Of the two, Emma looked more annoyed, waiting for my explanation. Liz looked horrified, her mouth moving as if she wanted to speak but had lost her vocal cords. I thought she'd make some comment about the bloodthirsty gods chasing us, but when she finally found her voice, she said, "That boy kissed you!" Leave it to Liz to have her priorities straight. "I will explain," I promised. "I know I'm a horrible friend for dragging you both into this, but please give me a moment. I need to concentrate." "Concentrate on what?" Emma demanded. "Emma, hush," Liz chided. "She said to let her concentrate." I closed my eyes, trying to calm my nerves. It wasn't easy, especially with an audience. Without my supplies, however, I was defenseless, and I wasn't likely to get another chance to retrieve them. I thought, "You can do this, Sadie. It's only reaching into another dimension, only ripping a tear in the fabric of reality." I reached out. Nothing happened. I tried again, and my hand disappeared into the duat. Liz shrieked. Fortunately, I didn't lose my concentration or my hand. My fingers closed around the strap of my magic bag, and I pulled it free. Emma's eyes widened. "That's brilliant. How did you do that?" I was wondering the same thing, actually. Given the circumstances, I couldn't believe I'd managed it on just my second try. "It's, magic," I said. My mates stared at me, mystified and scared, and the enormity of my problems suddenly came crashing down on me. A year ago, Liz, Emma, and I would have been riding this train to Funland or the cinema. We would have been laughing at the ridiculous ringtones on Lizzie's phone or Emma's photoshopped pictures of the girls we hated at school. The most dangerous things in my life had been Gran's cooking and Gramps' temper when he saw my marks for the term. Now Gramps was a giant baboon. Gran was an evil vulture. My friends were regarding me as if I'd dropped from another planet, which wasn't far from the truth. Even with my magic supplies in hand, I had no idea what I was going to do. I didn't have the full power of Isis at my command anymore. If I tried to fight Bobby and Nekbet, I might injure my own grandparents and would likely get myself killed. But if I didn't stop them, who would? Godly possession would eventually burn out a human host. That had almost happened to Uncle Amos, who was a full-fledged magician and knew how to defend himself. Gran and Gramps were old, frail, and quite unmagical. They didn't have much time. Despair, much worse than the vulture goddess's wings, overwhelmed me. I didn't realize I was crying until Liz put her hand on my shoulder. "Sadie, dear, we're sorry. It's just a bit strange, you know. Tell us what's the matter. Let us help." I took a shaky breath. I'd missed my mates so much. I'd always thought them a bit odd, but now they seemed blissfully normal, part of a world that wasn't mine anymore. They were both trying to act brave, but I could tell they were terrified inside. I wished I could leave them behind, hide them, keep them out of harm's way. But I remembered what Nekbet had said. They'll make lovely appetizers. Anubis had warned that the vulture goddess would hunt down my friends and hurt them just to hurt me. At least if they were with me, I could try to protect them. I didn't want to upend their lives the way mine had been, but I owed them the truth. "This will sound absolutely mad," I warned. I gave them the shortest version possible. Why I'd left London, how the Egyptian gods had escaped into the world, how I'd discovered my ancestry as a magician. I told them about our fight with Set, the rise of Apophis, and our insane idea to awaken the god Ra. 2 stations passed, but it felt so good to tell my friends the story that I rather lost track of time. When I was done, Liz and Emma looked at one another, no doubt wondering how to gently tell me I was bonkers. "I know it seems impossible," I said, "but Sadie, we believe you," Emma said. I blinked. "You do?" "Course we do." Liz's face was flushed, the way she got after several roller coaster rides. "I've never heard you talk so seriously about anything. You've changed. It's just I'm a magician now, and I can't believe how stupid that sounds. It's more than that. Emma studied my face as if I was turning into something quite frightening. You seem older, more mature. Her voice was tinged with sadness, and I realized my mates and I were growing apart. It was as if we stood on opposite sides of a widening chasm, and I knew with gloomy certainty the breach was already too wide for me to jump back across.
Your boyfriend is amazing, Liz added, probably to cheer me up.
He's not my... I stopped. There was no winning that argument with Liz. Besides, I was so mixed up about that bloody Jackal Anubis, I didn't know where to begin. The train slowed. I saw the signs for Waterloo Station. Oh, God, I said. I meant to get off at London Bridge. I need a bridge. Can't we backtrack? Liz asked. A roar from the tunnel behind us answered that question. Looking back, I saw a large shape with glittering silver fur loping along the tracks. Its foot touched the third rail and sparks flew, but the baboon god lumbered on, unfazed. As the train braked, Bobby started to gain on us. No going back, I said. We'll have to make it to Waterloo Bridge. That's half a mile from the station, Liz protested. What if it catches us? I rummaged through my bag and pulled out my new staff. Instantly, it expanded to full length, the lion-carved tip blazing with golden light. Then I suppose we'll have to fight. Should I describe Waterloo Station as it was before or after we destroyed it? The main concourse was massive. It had a polished marble floor, loads of shops and kiosks, and a glass and girder ceiling high enough so that a helicopter could fly about inside comfortably. Rivers of people flowed in and out, mixing, separating, and occasionally colliding as they made their way to various escalators and platforms. When I was small, the station building had rather frightened me. I worried that the giant Victorian clock hanging from the ceiling might fall and crush me. The announcers' voices were much too loud. I prefer to be the noisiest thing in my environment, thank you very much. The masses of commuters standing mesmerized under the departure boards watching for their trains reminded me of a mob in a zombie movie, which, granted, I shouldn't have watched as a young child, but I was always rather precocious. At any rate, my mates and I were racing through the main station, pushing our way toward the nearest exit, when a stairwell behind us exploded. Crowds scattered as Bobby climbed from the rubble. Businessmen screamed, dropping their briefcases and sprinting for their lives. Liz, Emma, and I pressed against the side of the paper chase kiosk to avoid getting trampled by a group of tourists yelling in Italian. Bobby howled. His fur was covered with grime and soot from his run through the tunnels. Gramps's cardigan was ripped to shreds on his arm, but miraculously, his glasses were still on his head. He sniffed the air, probably trying to catch my scent. Then a dark shadow passed overhead.
"Where are you going, Sadie Kane?"
Neckbet shrieked. She soared through the terminal, swooping down on the already panicked crowds.
"Would you fight by running away? You are not worthy!"
An announcer's calm voice echoed through the terminal. The 802 train for Basingstoke will arrive on Platform 3. Bobby swatted a bronze statue of some poor famous bloke and knocked his head clean off. A policeman ran forward, armed with a pistol. Before I could yell at him to stop, he fired a shot at Bobby. Liz and Emma both screamed. The bullet deflected off Bobby's fur as if it were made of titanium and shattered a nearby McDonald's sign. The officer fainted dead away. I'd never seen so many people clear out of a terminal so quickly. I considered following them, but decided it would be too dangerous. I couldn't have these insane gods killing loads of innocent people just because I was in their midst. And if we tried to join the Exodus, we'd only get stuck or crushed in a stampede. Sadie, look! Liz pointed up, and Emma yelped. Neckbet sailed into the ceiling girders and perched there with the pigeons. She glared down at us and cried to Bobby...
"Here she is, my dear, here!"
"I wish she'd shut up," I muttered.
"Isis was foolish to choose you!"
Neckbet yelled.
"I will feed on your entrails!"
said Bobby in hearty agreement. "The 8:14 train for Brighton is delayed," said the announcer. "We apologize for the inconvenience."
Bobby had seen us now. His eyes smoldered with primal rage, but I also saw something of Gramps in his expression, the way he furrowed his brow and jutted out his chin, just as Gramps did when he got angry at the telly and yelled at the rugby players. Seeing that expression on the baboon gourd almost made me lose my nerve. I wasn't going to die here. I wasn't going to let these two repulsive gods hurt my friends or burn up my grandparents. Bobby lumbered toward us. Now that he'd found us, he didn't seem in a hurry to kill us. He lifted his head and made a deep barking sound to the left and right, as if calling out, summoning friends for dinner. Emma's fingers dug into my arm. Liz whimpered, "Sadie?" The crowds had mostly cleared out now. No other police were in sight. Perhaps they'd fled, or perhaps they were all on their way to Canary Wharf, not realizing the problem was now here. "We're not going to die," I promised my mates. "Emma, hold my staff. You're..." "Oh, right." She took the staff gingerly, as if I'd handed her a rocket launcher, which I suppose it could have been with the proper spell. "Liz," I ordered, "watch the baboon." "Watching the baboon," she said. "Rather hard to miss the baboon." I rummaged through my magic bag, desperately taking inventory. Wand, good for defense, but against two gods at once I needed more. Sons of Horus, magic chalk. This wasn't the place to draw a protective circle. I had to get to the bridge. I needed to buy time to get out of this terminal. "Sadie," Liz warned. Bobby had jumped onto the roof of the body shop. He roared, and smaller baboons began to appear from every direction, climbing over the heads of fleeing commuters, swinging down from the girders, popping out of the stairwells and shops. There were dozens of them, all wearing black and silver basketball jerseys. Was basketball some sort of international baboon sport? Until today, I'd been rather fond of baboons. The ones I'd met before, like Hufu and his sociable friends, were the sacred animals of Toth, god of knowledge. They were generally wise and helpful. I suspected, however, that Bobby's troop of baboons was a different sort altogether. They had blood-red fur, wild eyes, and fangs that would have made a saber-toothed tiger feel inadequate. They began to close in, snarling as they prepared to pounce. I pulled a block of wax from my bag, no time to fashion a sharpie, two tight amulets, the sacred mask of Isis, those might be helpful. Then I found a corked glass vial I'd quite forgotten about. Inside was some murky sludge, my first attempt at a potion. It had been sitting at the bottom of my bag for ages because I'd never been desperate enough to test it. I shook the potion. The liquid glowed with a sickly green light. Bits of gunk swirled inside. I uncorked it. The stuff smelled worse than Nekbet. "What is that?" Liz asked. "Disgusting," I said. "Animation scroll blended with oil, water, and a few secret ingredients. Came out a bit chunky, I'm afraid." "Animation?" Emma asked. "You're going to summon cartoons?" "That would be brilliant," I admitted, "but this is more dangerous. If I do it right, I can ingest a great deal of magic without burning myself up." "And if you do it wrong?" Liz asked. I handed them each an amulet of Isis. "Hold on to these. When I say go, run for the taxi stands. Don't stop." "Sadie," Emma protested, "what on earth?" Before I could lose my nerve, I gagged down the potion. Above us, Nekbet cackled.
"Give up! You cannot oppose us!"
The shadow of her wings seemed to spread over the entire concourse, making the last of the commuters flee in panic and weighing me down with fear. I knew it was only a spell, but still, the temptation to accept a quick death was almost overwhelming. A few of the baboons got distracted by the smell of food and raided the McDonald's. Several others were chasing a train conductor, beating him with rolled-up fashion magazines. Sadly, most of the baboons were still focused on us. They made a loose ring around the paper chase kiosk. From his command station atop the body shop, Bobby howled, a clear command to attack. Then the potion hit my gut. Magic coursed through my body. My mouth tasted like I'd swallowed a dead toad, but now I understood why potions were so popular with ancient magicians.
The animation spell, which had taken me days to write and would normally take at least an hour to cast, was now tingling in my bloodstream. Power surged into my fingertips. My only problem was channeling the magic, making sure it didn't burn me to a crisp. I called on Isis as best I could, tapping her power to help me shape the enchantment. I envisioned what I wanted, and the right word of power popped into my head. Protect. Nandar. I released the magic. A gold hieroglyph burned in front of me. A wave of golden light rippled through the concourse. The troop of baboons hesitated. Bobby stumbled on the body shop roof. Even Nekbet squawked and faltered on the ceiling girders. All around the station, inanimate objects began to move. Backpacks and briefcases suddenly learned to fly. Magazine racks, gum, sweets, and assorted cold drinks exploded out of the shops and attacked the baboon troop. The decapitated bronze head from the statue shot out of nowhere and slammed into Bobby's chest, knocking him backward through the roof of the body shop. A tornado of pink Financial Times newspapers swirled toward the ceiling. They engulfed Nekbet, who stumbled blindly and fell shrieking from her perch in a flurry of pink and black. Go! I told my friends. We ran for the exit, weaving around baboons who were much too busy to stop us. One was being pummeled by a half-dozen bottles of sparkling water. Another was fending off a briefcase and several kamikaze blackberries. Bobby tried to rise, but a maelstrom of body shop products surged around him. Lotions, loofah sponges, and shampoos all battering him, squirting in his eyes, and trying to give him an extreme makeover. He bellowed in irritation, slipped, and fell back into the ruined shop. I doubted my spell would do the gods any permanent damage, but with luck it would keep them occupied for a few minutes. Liz, Emma, and I made it out of the terminal. With the entire station evacuated, I didn't really expect any cabs to be in the taxi queue, and indeed the curb was empty. I resigned myself to running all the way to Waterloo Bridge, though Emma had no shoes, and the potion had made me queasy. Look, Liz said. Oh, well done, Sadie, Emma said. What? I asked. What did I do? Then I noticed the chauffeur, an extremely short, scruffy man standing at the end of the drive in a black suit, holding a placard that read, Kane. I suppose my friends thought I'd summoned him by magic. Before I could tell them differently, Emma said, Come on! And they sprinted toward the little man. I had no choice but to follow. I remembered what Anubis had said about sending my driver to meet me. I supposed this must be him, but the closer we got, the less eager I was to meet him. He was shorter than me by half, stouter than my Uncle Amos, and uglier than anyone else on the planet. His facial features were positively Neanderthal. Under his thick, furry monobrow, one eye was bigger than the other. His beard looked as if it had been used to scrape greasy pots. His skin was poxy with red welts, and his hair looked like a bird's nest that had been set on fire, then stomped out. When he saw me, he scowled, which did nothing to help his appearance.
About time.
His accent was American. He belched into his fist, and the smell of curry nearly knocked me over.
Fasts, friend, Sadie Kane?
Possibly. I decided to have a serious talk with Bast about her choice of friends. Just by the way, we have two gods trying to kill us. The warty little man smacked his lips, clearly unimpressed.
Guess you'll want a bridge, then.
He turned toward the curb and yelled,
Boo!
A black Mercedes limousine appeared out of nowhere as if it had been scared into existence. The chauffeur glanced back at me and arched his brow.
Well, get in.
I'd never been in a limousine before. I hope most are nicer than the one we took. The back seat was littered with takeaway curry containers, old fish and chip paper, crisp bags, and various dirty socks. Despite this, Emma, Liz, and I crammed together in the back because none of us dared to ride up front. You may think I was mad to get in a car with a strange man. You're right, of course, but Bast had promised us help and Anubis had told me to expect a driver. The fact that our promised help was a little man with bad hygiene and a magical limousine did not particularly surprise me. I'd seen stranger things. Also, I didn't have much choice. The potion had worn off, and the strain of releasing so much magic had made me light-headed and wobbly-legged. I wasn't sure I could have walked to Waterloo Bridge without passing out. The chauffeur floored the gas and barreled out of the station. The police had cordoned it off, but our limo swerved around the barricades, past a cluster of BBC news vans and a mob of spectators, and no one paid us any attention. The chauffeur started whistling a tune that sounded like short people. His head barely reached the headrest. All I could see of him was a grubby nest of hair and a set of furry hands on the wheel. Stuck in the sun visor was an identification card with his picture, sort of. It had been taken at point-blank range, showing only an out-of-focus nose and a hideous mouth, as if he'd been trying to eat the camera. The card read, "Your driver is Bess." "Your Bess, I guess?" I said.
"Yes,"
he said. "Your car's a mess," Liz muttered.
"If one more person rhymes," Emma grumbled, "I'll throw up."
"Is it Mr. Bess?" I asked, trying to place his name from Egyptian mythology. I was fairly sure they hadn't had a god of chauffeurs.
"Lord Bess? Bess the extremely short?"
"Just Bess," he grunted. "One S. And no, it's not a girl's name. Call me Bessie and I'll have to kill you. As for being short, I am the dwarf god, so what do you expect? Oh, there's bottled water for you back there if you're thirsty."
I looked down. Rolling about at my feet were two partially empty bottles of water. One had lipstick on the cap, the other looked as if it had been chewed on. "Not thirsty," I decided. Liz and Emma murmured agreement. I was surprised they weren't absolutely catatonic after the evening's events, but then again, they were my mates. I didn't hang out with weak-willed girls, did I? Even before I discovered magic, it took a strong constitution and a fair amount of adaptability to be my friend. And no comment from you, Carter. Police vehicles were blocking Waterloo Bridge, but Bess swerved around them, jumped the pavement, and kept driving. The police didn't even blink. "Are we invisible?" I asked.
"To most mortals," Bess belched. "They're pretty dense, aren't they? Present company accepted, etc."
"You're really a god?" Liz asked.
"Huge," Bess said. "I'm huge in the world of gods."
"A huge god of dwarves?" Emma marveled. "You mean as in Snow White or
all dwarves?"
Bess waved his hands expansively, which made me a bit nervous as he took both of them off the wheel.
"Egyptians were smart. They honored people who were born unusual. Dwarves were considered extremely magical. So yeah, I'm the god of dwarves."
Liz cleared her throat.
"Isn't there a more polite term we're supposed to use nowadays? Like little person, or vertically challenged, or..."
"I'm not going to call myself the god of vertically challenged people," Bess grumbled. "I'm a dwarf. Now, here we are, just in time."
He spun the car to a stop in the middle of the bridge. Looking behind us, I almost lost the contents of my stomach. A winged black shape was circling over the riverbank. At the end of the bridge, Bobby was taking care of the barricade in his own fashion. He was throwing police cars into the River Thames while the officers scattered and fired their weapons, though the bullets seemed to have no effect on the baboon god's steely fur. "Why are we stopping?" Emma asked. Bess stood on his seat and stretched, which he could do quite easily.
"It's a river," he said. "Good place to fight gods, if I do say so myself. All that force of nature flowing underneath our feet makes it hard to stay anchored in the mortal world."
Looking at him more closely, I could see what he meant. His face was shimmering like a mirage. A lump formed in my throat. This was the moment of truth. I felt sick from the potion and from fear. I wasn't at all sure I had enough magic to combat those two gods, but I had no choice. "Liz, Emma," I said, "we're getting out."
"Getting out?" Liz whimpered.
Emma swallowed.
"Are you sure?"
"I know you're scared," I said, "but you'll need to do exactly as I say." They nodded hesitantly and opened the car doors. The poor things. Again, I wished I'd left them behind, but honestly, after seeing my grandparents possessed, I couldn't stand the idea of letting my friends out of my sight. Bess stifled a yawn.
"Need my help?"
Bobby was lumbering toward us, Neckbit circled over him, shrieking orders. If the river was affecting them at all, they didn't show it. I didn't see how a dwarf god could stand against those two, but I said, "Yes, I need help."
"Right."
Bess cracked his knuckles.
"So, get out."
"What?"
"I can't change my clothes with you in the car, can I? I have to put on my ugly outfit."
"Ugly outfit?"
"Go," the dwarf commanded. "I'll be out in a minute."
It didn't take much encouragement. None of us wanted to see any more of Bess than we had to. We got out, and Bess locked the doors behind us. The windows were heavily tinted, so I couldn't see in. For all I knew, Bess would be relaxing, listening to music, while we got slaughtered. I certainly didn't have much hope that a wardrobe change was going to defeat Neckbet and Bobby. I looked at my frightened mates, then at the two gods charging toward us. "We'll make our last stand here." "Oh, no, no," Liz said. "I really don't like the term, last stand." I rummaged through my bag and took out a piece of chalk and the four sons of Horus. "Liz, put these statues at the cardinal points, north, south, and so on. Emma, take the chalk. Draw a circle connecting the statues. We only have a few seconds." I traded her chalk for my staff, then had a horrible flash of déjà vu. I'd just ordered my friends into action exactly as Zia Rashid had bossed me the first time we'd faced an enemy god together.